Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Let's meet our guests. First of all, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, Richard Maurer of the Anchorage Daily News, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Jill, you spent a number of days at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention last week here in Anchorage. Tell us about the major developments.
Well, I think this was a convention to talk about the issues that are pressing up against Alaska Natives, and particularly those that are living in rural Alaska. Energy was a huge concern. Education is a huge concern. The subsistence issue and Aboriginal rights is a huge concern, and the health of the salmon run. So it was a large, expansive discussion this year. Some items did rise to the top, particularly as relates to subsistence and Aboriginal rights. They passed a resolution calling for upon its membership to not only vote for a constitutional convention, but also to push for a constitutional amendment to the state constitution, kind of enshrining in law, in state law, Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights.
Through a constitutional convention. And didn't they also call for an amendment that would allow direct appropriations of state money to education,
you know,
to Native organizations?
I am not as up to speed on the education component, so you may know more about that than I did. I know that I sat in on one panel discussion on education. It was related on a slightly different topic: local control, more language immersion, more cultural immersion, more connection of the local communities to their students, and how do you achieve that when you're faced with like this large overarching structure like No Child Left Behind. You have dwindling school attendance levels because villages are so small, these kinds of issues.
Let's touch on the atmosphere of the convention. There are many people, viewers, who can't go. They're busy working, and it is one of the remarkable events Alaska has to offer as you go, and there are thousands of natives and their friends who are there, and there's probably no other convention in Alaska or maybe even the United States where you'll see as many children.
No.
Of all ages. It's remarkable.
It is. And, you know, you'll recall that just prior to the kickoff of the official AFN convention is the Elders and Youth Conference, which brings in intentionally young people and elders from around the state to have conversations about how they forge their relationships into the future and kind of build better lives and opportunity for each other. So that, you know, the first two or three days of the week, that convention center is stacked with kids.
I also enjoyed meeting the salespeople. There are all kinds of items that are for sale, furs and so forth. I ran into a fellow who was selling seal oil.
Wow.
And I said, you know, I think I'm really the wrong guy. I'm an old gussock. And the man looked at me and said, old gussock, you need seal oil.
That's great.
Jill, finally, Governor Parnell and the congressional delegation addressed the convention. I heard some of the addresses. I heard Begich and I heard most of Don Young. My question is, where does meeting the needs of your constituents and their concerns end and pandering begin?
Yeah, that's the hot potato question, right? So I listened to those same speeches and I had the same thought myself. I mean, on the one hand, they're kind of standing on their records. Here, what is what I have done for you legislatively, either that's been passed or that's been successful. Parnell kind of enumerated his I can't remember the name of his movement, Choose Respect, you know, his anti-violence campaign. The First Lady spoke about the need to really protect young Alaska Native women from sexual predators. And he talked about how, Governor Parnell talked about how he has installed more law enforcement into communities. But of course, it's still not enough. We still have a lot of communities that are underserved with respect to law enforcement needs. Don Young, kind of the same thing. He's like, I've fought for you in the past. I'll fight for you again. Beware of government,
you know. Also told them he didn't see why they couldn't have control of the whole Yukon River.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Senator Murkowski, for her part, acknowledged she would have hearings. There were some other measures that she might take. But both of them stopped short of kind of signing on and endorsing this push, both at the federal level and the state level, by the Alaska Native, the Alaska Federation of Natives, to have constitutional changes that protect their hunting and fishing rights above all others. And I think that that was telling. You know, they were able to say a bunch of stuff. Yeah. I don't know how reasonable Don Young's, you know, recommendation that the Yukon River corridor be solely managed by the Alaska Native villages that populate it from its mouth to the Yukon border
is. For one thing, there's a treaty with Canada.
There is a treaty with Canada. Now, certainly there's precedent for Native communities to have control of their lands and resources and regions in the lower 48. They do it successfully. They do it successfully with co-management and kind of government-to-government relations.
Yeah.
I think that's some of what the Alaska Native community up here is talking about, but we haven't really done that up here. And it kind of pits the Alaska Native community against the state, or as an ally with the state, or against the feds, or as an ally with the feds, depending on which government relationship is most advantageous
Isn't
to the topic at hand. So it's fascinating.
You want to get in here, Steve or Richard, or should we move on here?
Well, I was just amazed that the subsistence issue came up. It was something that we certainly heard a lot about in the 90s. Former Governor Tony Knowles tried many times to try to get a constitutional amendment passed, at least get one passed the legislature and get it on the ballot, and he never was able to do that. The issue has just been kind of in the weeds a little bit. You just haven't heard about it, and then have it come out at AFN like that. It surprised me anyways that it's an issue, and it's very much on the front burner again.
Let's go to Jill.
No, go ahead.
Okay, let's go to Richard Maurer. Richard, there's so much to say about the political campaign. Mm-hmm. Let's take it in pieces. And the first piece is Bob Bell is fined by the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Seems to be a resolution of this particular charge.
It seems that way. Actually, since covering this election since late spring, I think I need seal oil. Bob Bell, when he filed his every public official has to file their financial disclosure. The rules had changed in last year about what you had to disclose if you were like Bob Bell and ran an engineering company. In the old days, if you owned the company or had more than 50%, you had to disclose the clients and how much they paid. He got rid of the company, gave it to an employee stock program, but remained the CEO, remained the principal operator there. And so he didn't disclose who his clients were, he didn't disclose how much they paid. Finally, in early October, he did. And it turned out that his biggest client was BP, and that as a legislator who has to deal with oil taxes, certainly it's something you should
want to know.
If he becomes a senator.
Yeah, I talked to one Democrat who was involved in this, and mm-hmm. it was quite clear to me, and he more or less conceded it, that they wanted the headline that said mm-hmm. Bob Bell fined, even if he was fined only $1. Now he was fined what? How many dollars?
$390.
Okay.
But you know, APOC has a long history of levying pretty insubstantial fines, and it is that headline that people fear, I think, rather than the dollar amount.
And now with the next day, we have a headline mm-hmm. that talks about a complaint that's been filed against Bell's opponent Hollis Frunch by a Republican operative, and Randy Friedrich and the incoming chairman of the Republican Party were right there to shepherd the complaint.
Right. The press conference where they announced this complaint was billed as discovery of a major violation of campaign rules.
Shocking, no doubt.
We all got there, and the evidence, the first bit of evidence that the operative, Bernadette Wilson, cites is the fact that the same bookkeeper filled out the form for Hollis French that filled out the form for this independent group run by the AFL-CIO, and to say that's thin is an understatement. There was a little bit more about who produced the commercials, but it's the kind of thing that if I were to have come across that looking through forms, I probably wouldn't have given it more than a minute's thought. I think because there's a press conference, other reporters are there. It kind of forces you to put something in the paper, but I think enough was said about who was pushing this complaint that readers had a pretty good idea that maybe this was pretty thin, and an effort by the Republicans to try and help Bob Bell back.
And there's one more Bob Bell question, and that is the story or non-story mm-hmm. about his muskox hunt. Can you tell us about that?
Probably Jill could do a little bit better with that. But there was it's sort of a question of did Bob Bell, when he was on the game board, did he abuse his power on the game board by going on a muskox hunt with the chairman of the game board and the head of the wildlife division? and then attempt to take the horns back on a, basically a subsistence hunt where you're supposed to leave the horns in the district. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's not so much even about the abuse of power as knowing what the rules are, knowing what the law is. It had come up in discussion at a Board of Game meeting and still trying to find a way to perhaps get around it. The horns are supposed to be left. They weren't left. They were given to an artist. That artist then carved them, and Bob Bell purchased horns from the artist, presumably the same set of horns that had been delivered to her. So now the horns are both out of the home region, they've been carved, they're fully intact, which is also against the rules. And I know that when our reporter, Amanda Coyne, was diving into this, she had started asking a lot of questions and talking to a lot of people, and at least one official from the Department of Fish and Game and two Alaska State Troopers were bristling at hearing that this had taken place, that these horns still existed intact, that they were in Anchorage, and that they had been carved. That having been said, today we have heard from the Alaska State Troopers that they've exhausted all leads. They wouldn't say whether or not there is or is not an active investigation underway. And I know it was Amanda's belief that there's kind of this gag order now among the troopers, and it's become political. So for whatever reason, it appears to be stalled out, and you know whether that means something improper transpired or not, I don't know that we'll know.
Well, in Bob Bell's defense, what he says is, when I brought these horns, I took the horns off the animal, I cut them in the way you're supposed to cut them, I brought them to an artist who put them in a pile of horns. Mm-hmm. Months later, I asked her to carve something on these two horns. She carved whatever I wanted, sent me horns. I have no idea if these are the same horns. She had no idea if these are the same
horns. Yeah, I didn't go up there
horns.
And pick them out or something
right,
like that.
Right, right. So that's what he says, and there's no, I don't know of any evidence counter to
and
that.
And that doesn't seem to have emerged as, or has it emerged as much of an issue in that South Anchorage district?
I don't think so.
I mean, West Anchorage district.
Mm-hmm. I know we had heard that there was some allegation that this was, you know, a story that had been pitched and positioned by Senator French, Bell's campaign challenger, or I guess Bell's the challenger, French is the incumbent, and that never took place. I mean, we didn't hear anything from any political groups or outside groups kind of calling up and, you know, suggesting that somebody pursue this.
Okay, let's go to Steve McDonald. Steve, there's $50 million in bonds on the election ballot coming up in November for the Port of Anchorage, and there's also a study of the Port of Anchorage that the Mayor Sullivan has in hand that he can't talk about. Sort this out for us.
No, I don't know if I can. Yeah, the $50 million, I can tell you about that. That's part of a big big transportation bond that's on the ballot for November. There's about $400+ million that in that ballot proposition, and this $50 million is contained in there to forward the port project. They're trying to expand the port to allow more ships to come in there, and different types of ships as well. It is a project that has been fraught with problems, not only construction issues, but also cost overruns, and the mayor's been trying to deal with that. He's had to scale the project down a little bit and leave the rest of the project for future mayors to decide whether or not they want to proceed with that. But this $50 million would forward the project somewhat. He was a little perplexed, Mayor Sullivan was, on Wednesday when he had a news conference and reporters asked him about this $2 million contract with an attorney with a law office outside. He said that was a deal that was struck with the assembly in an executive session and shouldn't be made public, but the reporters basically said, well, wait a minute, it's on the agenda for the 30th of October, so it's already been made public. So he's got an outside law firm litigating this on behalf of the city to try to determine if they can recoup some of the losses that they've suffered with these cost overruns. So the confidentiality, that part of it, he can't talk about a study that was undertaken again with this port project. So it's a pretty complex issue, and it's going to be a while before all of this is sorted out.
Richard, I'm going to ask you a philosophical question here, and that is, it really seems that politicians should be very careful before they sign confidentiality agreements with the oil companies, with this port study, whatever it is.
Well, that's really true, especially because the mayor should have a responsibility to talk to the public about what he, and this is a document that he's going to talk about anyway on, what, November 9th, 3 days
yes.
after the election,
right.
When voters have, so 3 days after voters are asked whether to approve
the
bonds.
To give them $50 million.
He's going to talk about this document is going to become public anyway. Why does it have to wait till after the election?
And this is, again, this is not an individual appropriation or proposition that's on the ballot. It's not like Proposition 5, $50 million for the port.
It's about 10%. Well, it's more than 10% of $433 million or something.
That's right.
Like
it's
that.
Part of
it's
a
the biggest
much larger...
item in the bond. I have looked at it.
It is, okay.
Biggest single item.
Yeah.
Steve, one of the things that frustrates the general public, I think, is they try to figure out who's accountable here for the problems at the port, and you can't get an answer to that.
No,
or
no,
can't get a straight answer to
get,
it.
It's like I said. This is turned into quite a. I don't want to call it a white elephant, but this is a really important part of the state of Alaska. The old refrain goes, there's hardly an item that Alaskans don't eat or wear or drive that doesn't come through the port. Everything just about comes through the port of Anchorage and then goes off to its destinations. This is a very important piece of property. It's an economic driver for the state and for the city. The project it deals with some pilings that were being driven into the floor of Cook Inlet that weren't matching up. They weren't hinging properly. They were being bent over. They were damaged while they were being put together. And part of this confidentiality agreement, I think, also includes a decision of whether or not this project can go forward under the present design, whether they have to go back to something different. And I don't know if that means starting over, or if they could just kind of make the rest of the expansion project conform to these new ideas, or if the project itself can be salvaged in the way it was designed. So there's a lot hinging on this. And
maybe we'll all talk about this after we approve the $50 million. Or something like that. Richard Maurer, headline on your story, protesters say no to outside money in politics. A demo, I don't know how big it was, you were there, tell us what you see.
It was noisy, it was about 40, 50 people, a lot of them from the AFL-CIO, some from Backbone, the organization that wants the legislature to stand up, what they say, stand up to the industry. It was about money that was coming in to an organization that had Republican in its name, which is why they chose the Republican Party headquarters to protest, but is not affiliated with the Republican Party. It's one of these independent groups. And so they were basically saying, don't let them, they were going to contribute something on the order of six figures to some organizations in the state. They wouldn't disclose which ones they were. But they were just saying keep this Alaskan. There's plenty of money in the state of Alaska on this issue as
now,
well.
Now, can the Democrats say with purity that they're not receiving outside money or groups that may be friends of the Democrats? They can't be aligned with them. Whatever it is, that there's no money coming up here from Seattle. Can they say that?
And this issue, probably not. I mean, who's going to be sending money to Alaska to vote down oil, North Dakota, to vote down oil taxes? You know, but in the past, there's been plenty of money from outside given to Democratic causes and Republican causes since basically time began, I'm sure.
And this particular group that you mentioned, what are the reporting requirements going to be on them from the Public Offices Commission, if any? I'm just not familiar with
them. I'm not that familiar either. I think we'll get to know, because they're not spending the money directly on commercials or those kinds of things. They're giving the money to another group. So I think we'll get to see from the groups that get the money that they receive money from the Republican State Leadership Council, whatever it's called. but we're not going to see who gives money to them. But that's money's available. You can see the, how much they get from Open Secrets and other
the website.
The websites.
Yeah. Yeah. Steve, any thoughts here?
No, it's just hard. If the Democrats say that if anybody from a Democratic type of organization affiliated with the Democrats or however that works, they would do the exact same thing. They would want them out.
So. And on the other hand, it was a little unusual to see Malcolm Roberts
that was
protesting
surprising.
In front
yes.
of the Republican yeah. headquarters.
Right, right. He's synonymous with Governor Hickel, you know. Right. And yeah, it was kind of fun to see him out there. Yeah.
Jill, different. You got anything here, or should we continue on? Okay. Richard, finally here on politics, this phase of politics. Former Representative Pete Kelly in Fairbanks, now running for the state Senate against Democratic incumbent Joe Pascavan, has taken great affront at being called a lobbyist. Explain this to us.
Well, I think in some circles or some ways of saying someone's a lobbyist is like spitting on the floor, you know. But the guy, his job was to lobby for the university, to promote the university in the legislature and elsewhere.
He says I was director of state relations.
That sounds like lobbyist to me, but get over it, I guess.
I mean, I think that's
well, here's something else that you I know you're an expert on. Pascavan's making quite a bit of noise about him receiving VECO money. And I guess it seems to me what Kelly's trying to say is, well, that really wasn't important, or I didn't know what VECO was doing then, or that's when VECO was the good VECO and not the bad VECO. I mean, is there a statute of limitations here on VECO or not?
That's up to the voters to decide whether there's a statute of limitations. I think VECO has been VECO since at least the 80s. So I don't think that they changed their stripes in 2006 when they got caught. I think VECO has always been VECO.
Yeah, and they were fined in the, you can correct me if it was Mr. Allen, Bill Allen who was fined, or whether it was actually the company in the 80s for bundling money in a variety
That's
of
That's right.
So they changed their methods.
They were investigated many times for contributions in the name of others. VECO has had a long...
Oh, and the refund program.
There's been a long history of VECO and campaign contributions and other kinds of contributions.
And abuses. Okay. Jill, murder suspect Israel Keyes' home was searched again. Why, and why at this stage of the investigation?
Well, it's my understanding that nobody was willing to say anything about why. I mean, obviously, there's something they still want. we know it was a federal warrant. We know that warrants to remain sealed. I know that in past high-profile cases like this that we've seen, often when you make the arrest, you still don't have all the evidence gathered. You have enough to make the arrest and to have a judge say, okay, we agree, we should probably be hanging on to this guy. There's enough here to bring this person into court. And the cases continue to build during the interim between the arrest or the lodging of charges and the actual execution of the case. My guess is that they are looking, I mean, who knows? Maybe they haven't recovered the murder weapon yet. Maybe they think there was something at the Keyes home that relates to the other crimes in which he is being looked at for out of state in Vermont, a couple that went missing and has presumed to be dead, that he was known to be in the same city nearby. And there have been federal search warrants executed in that case out of state. So, I think it's difficult to say, but I know that he is somebody that the government is very intent on prosecuting seriously and believes is a very bad guy.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say we should note, too, that about the same time they were descending on that West Anchorage home, law enforcement officials in upstate New York were ascending on a farm or a piece of property with some buildings on it that Keyes allegedly owns as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
This was happening right around the same time. It's upstate New York near the Canadian border, and again, presumably, they were looking for evidence in connection to what happened to this Vermont couple. But they were searching his property there, too.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Richard Maurer. Richard, your colleague Lisa Diemer has a lengthy report on the socially conservative entity Alaska Family Council becoming vigorously involved in the fall campaign. What can you tell us based on Lisa Diemer's reporting?
Well, the idea here is that while oil taxes is the big issue, the big money issue that people are bringing in the Senate campaign, if the Senate changes and becomes more conservative, there's a possibility that these other issues, social issues, school choice, restrictions on abortion, those kinds of things could come in as well, because you don't have you have a situation where the Senate President Gary Stevens from Kodiak kept his coalition together by saying we're not going to touch the ideas that are way out here or way out here. No very liberal ideas, no very conservative ideas. We're going to try and stay down the middle and keep to the things that we can all agree on, and so that prevented all these other things from arising. And so I think that one of the things Lisa Diemer was reporting on was the idea that if the Senate changes hands on the basis of oil taxes, other things are going to happen.
Now, let me ask you, I've always assumed that these, what these people mm-hmm. really excelled at was turning out voters, but can mm-hmm. they also raise money, or do we know?
I don't think there's a shortage of money. I think there may be, I think the issue here is getting people excited and going to the polls.
Especially in a year when there doesn't seem to be much excitement about the presidential election,
and
here anyway.
And it's not just the Alaska Family Council, but then you have on the Democratic side, you have candidates saying, "Well, look what they're going to do if they get into power. You better go out and vote." You know, public employees, they're going to try and strip the unions.
And we're out of time. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.